Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
When we talk about the unemployment rate, we're using an average. That includes both the low rate of 4% in Fargo, North Dakota, and the almost unimaginable 27% in El Centro, California. And unemployment is often at its worst in towns that relied on a single industry.
They're closing down textile mills across the railroad tracks. Foreman says these jobs are going, boys, and they ain't coming back.
5% unemployment in Omaha, Nebraska, almost 20% in Yuma, Arizona. All of the individual stories from unique places that make up a national average. What's it like where you live?
Be your own town. Be your own town.
Moving from the general to the specific, the view from Main Street on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, March 5th. Todd Zwillick is with me today, filling in for John while he's out.
Good morning, Celeste. Let's take a look at this morning's top stories. The unemployment rate held steady at 9.7% in February, shedding fewer jobs than expected. Economists hope that means the job market may be slowly healing. The Labor Department said employers cut 36,000 jobs. Now, some economists say it may actually be a net gain in jobs because people who didn't get paid for having to stay home during recent snowstorms in the Northeast were counted as unemployed.
But unemployment across the country is patchy. It's higher in some areas than others. For a look at how unemployment has affected the small economic engines of America, small towns, we're joined now by Jay McLaughlin. He's chair of the Community Council of Glenwood, Washington. And Jay, what is the unemployment rate in Glenwood? Good morning.
Good morning.
What is the unemployment rate in Glenwood?
You know, the best figures we have are countywide, and they've dropped down to just under 12%.
12% is still pretty high. What are the ideas there in your city for getting jobs back?
At this point, it's perseverance. There's not a whole lot we can do in our community that's so dependent on the timber economy.
Grit your teeth and get through it, I guess. Jay McLaughlin, stay with us. We'll be back with you in a moment.
The gunman who shot two Pentagon police officers last night is being described as very well-educated and well-dressed. 36-year-old John Patrick Bedell approached a security checkpoint, pulled a gun from his pocket, and opened fire. He was killed when the officers who were wearing bulletproof vests returned fire. Pentagon Police Chief Richard Keevil says the cops should be okay.
One of the officers was hit in the thigh. The other was hit at the top of his shoulder. Both were superficial.
Police say Bedell has had previous run-ins with authorities. President Obama wants to see progress on the health care reform bill before he leaves for a trip in Asia in 2 weeks. He huddled with more than a dozen House Democrats at the White House yesterday, telling them the chance to overhaul health care was the opportunity of a lifetime. After that meeting, Congressman Joe Crowley from New York told reporters,
I think when all's said and done, we will have the votes to pass health care reform.
The Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he hopes to unveil a reconciliation bill that will help pass health care next week.
And overseas, Iraqis living abroad have begun casting ballots in their homeland's parliamentary elections. Those are scheduled for Sunday. Taking a look at the markets, the Asian and European markets are up, as are futures. The Dow will start at 10,444. The S&P opens at 1,122. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,292. Well, you probably recognize the name Bobby McFerrin, and you almost surely recognize the song Don't Worry, Be Happy. But we're going to change what you think you know about Bobby McFerrin with a story about the power of family later this hour.
And also coming up later this morning, we're talking about a controversy where a team of white dancers won a competition in stepping. Now, that's a dance style predominantly danced by black folks. You can find out more details on the website at thetakeaway.org. But we're asking you, what does this story say about race? We want to open it up to you. Are there examples that you've seen of one race owning something?
This is Sarah calling from New York City. African Americans do not own step dancing any more than whites own golf or tennis or classical music. In this so-called post-racial era, I'm surprised that we should even be talking about this.
Call us 8778-MY-TAKE or post to the site at thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. John Hockenberry is out sick today. I am joined by Todd Zwillick, who came up from Washington to fill in. Good morning, Todd.
Morning.
We are expecting new national unemployment data out in an hour or so to give us an idea of where the economy is moving on the large scale. But like I said before, that national data is an average. What about the individual data points that are the small manufacturing towns, the small economic engines of the United States, especially manufacturing jobs? They've taken a really hard hit. And we were trying to find out what happens to some of these small towns when the big plants shut down. Joining us for our small town economic roundtable, we have from Glenwood, Washington, again, Jay McLaughlin joins us, the chair of Glenwood's Community Council. Also, Mayor Paul Grenier from Berlin, New Hampshire, and finally, Mayor Jack Scoville of Georgetown, South Carolina. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jay, let's return to you for a moment. How large a town is Glenwood, Washington?
Very small, only about 500 people.
And what historically was your economic engine?
Timber.
And when did timber start to go south?
Actually, two decades ago, in the early 1990s.
So it hasn't been very long.
Hasn't been real long, no.
And what's replacing it?
At this point, we're still hanging on with timber. A little bit more tourism than maybe in the past, but still very much a forest-dependent economy.
Okay, Mayor Scoville, let's talk about Georgetown, South Carolina. How many people live in Georgetown, and what's the economic engine there been historically?
The city itself has about 9,500. The surrounding counties around, I think, about 90,000. We are a 300-year-old community, rice, indigo, way back when. We are a seaport. We've historically been sort of the commercial hub of this part of South Carolina.
And you're a manufacturing town?
Well, to a large degree. We have a steel mill that's now closed right in the middle of town, and we have a paper mill that's on the edge of town, and two other large manufacturing concerns that are in the county that provide a lot of jobs for our citizens. We're going to be promoting tourism a lot more, and hopefully the steel mill will reopen in the next year or two.
Okay, and what's your unemployment there in Georgetown, South Carolina?
The county is about 14.5%.
Okay, and finally to you, Paul, what is it like in Berlin, New Hampshire?
Well, we've got a city that in the 30s was about 22,000 people, and now we believe through the censuses we're going to be right around 10,500 people. We were a community that was born from the pulp and paper industry, and the people who built the pulp and paper mills at the turn of the 20th century originally came here and operated sawmills. In the early 20th century, we had an IP mill and Brown Company. We actually had two pulp and paper mills here in the city, and now that has evaporated. We have still have a small paper mill in the surrounding community of Gorham that used to draw pulp from Berlin here. So our pulp and paper mills have just about all gone away. At one point in time, the industry employed about 4,000 people, and now we've got about 350 people left in the industry.
Okay, so Paul of Berlin, New Hampshire, what is the unemployment rate there around?
Berlin's unemployment rate is about 10%. We've had a pretty significant out-migration of folks, but in the northernmost county of New Hampshire called Coos County, our unemployment rate mirrors the fellow in South Carolina. We're about 14-15%.
So all three of you are from cities in which your real unemployment rate is actually higher than the national average. Jay, let me ask you about that national average. Do you kind of see economic numbers coming out nationally that make you feel like those have applications in your town? Or do you kind of feel like your town is an individual place and it's going to come out of the recession when it is ready?
I'd say the latter, much more of an individual place, and even within our county, because the numbers that we look at are countywide. Within our county, I have the impression that we have quite a bit of variability in the eastern portion of the county. It's much more open. It isn't forested. There's been quite a bit of activity and development associated with wind farms going in. But in the western portion of the county, which is forested and much more tied to the timber industry, times have been much harder.
Okay, Jack Scoville in Georgetown, South Carolina. How about you? Do you see some of the maybe the federal initiatives? Do you think that there's hope for you coming out of some of the stimulus money or the things that are large macro projects?
Well, we are getting ready to start about a $15 million drainage project here in the city, and we've got a couple of million dollars of stimulus money for that. Hopefully that'll create some construction jobs for local people. The steel mill is dependent on the international steel market. They have not closed permanently, and hopefully they'll reopen in the next year or two if international steel prices, you know, get high enough to warrant that. We're promoting tourism very hard here. We are a historic seaport town and unique. We've got actually more pre-Revolutionary War houses here than Charleston, South Carolina. So a lot of people discover us and are surprised. They think we're sort of a grimy mill town, but when they take the time to come to our downtown, they're very surprised at how, you know, beautiful a little historic town we have. So we really promote right now tourism, but of course that's affected by the national economy too.
Well, Paul Grenier, let me ask you, as mayor of Berlin, New Hampshire, you know, it's not just Detroit that is adversely affected when you're focused on one particular industry. What advice can you give to other mayors of other towns that were really kind of reliant on one particular industry?
All I can say is work to diversify your economy. Back in the early 2000s, late 1990s and 2000s, we recognized that we were slipping away. We have since located a New Hampshire State prison here in Berlin, which employs 300 people, and we are at the end of a federal corrections prison here that will be opening up next year, and it's going to employ about 400 people, and we're getting into renewable energy, biomass, power facilities, and we have windmills that are going to be going up about 50 miles north of us. So we have been very, very active in the last 15 years to counteract what I would consider a long, slow decline in timber-related businesses.
Okay, a little snapshot of small towns across the United States that kind of put these national unemployment rates into perspective. That's Paul Grenier, mayor of Berlin, New Hampshire. We also spoke with Jack Scoville, mayor of Georgetown, South Carolina, and Jay McLaughlin, who's chair of the Community Council of Glenwood, Washington. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on the headlines.
Monday unemployment numbers came out. In the past hour, the unemployment rate was unchanged in February. It remained at 9.7%. Meanwhile, the chief of the Pentagon Police Force says the gunman who shot two police officers last night was well-armed and probably acted alone. He says John Patrick Bedell had two 9mm semi-automatic weapons with him. The officers are okay, but the gunman was killed.
Well, we've all watched the Oscars when the thank you speeches go on forever.
I just want to... Oh, here we go. Okay, the studio, I love you, and Cameron Crowe, and Tom Cruise.
That was Cuba Gooding Jr. ignoring the Get Off the Stage music as he won his Oscar for Jerry Maguire. It's moments like this that not only make the Oscars interminably long, but have caused organizers to crack down on these long thank yous. The Academy's Tom Sherrick says award winners will now be asked to leave the stage and finish their thank yous off screen on a special camera that streams to the internet, and here's why.
Just being who they are and expressing what's coming from their heart is so much more interesting than thanking people.
The Oscars are on Sunday night. Finally, a little story from across the world. The daughter of a crown prince of Japan has been off school after complaining of bullying. Royal spokesman said the princess, who is 8, has been treated harshly by boys from another class. And so if you thought being royal would protect you from bullying, think again.
I never thought that being royal would protect me from bullying.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, unemployment numbers out in the past hour. What do they really mean in the scope of this reception? Maybe not a lot, maybe a lot.
Hey, you want that to go?
Hey, good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John this morning. We've got some takeouts on stories we're following. Last month's U.S. unemployment numbers are out this morning. Now, unemployment numbers held steady at 9.7%. That's for February. But there's a bigger picture here than just the numbers, and it's one that shows our current recession may be different, deeper, really, than any recession we've ever had in the past. Indeed, there's a lot of people who call this one the Great Recession. Well, joining us now is friend of the Takeaway, Lakshman Achathan. Lakshman is managing director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, a market analyst company that forecasts recessions and recoveries. And we've got quite a recession here, Lakshman, and the recovery is the question. Now, you're saying that the depth of this recession has really divided Americans into two huge groups of unemployed.
Absolutely. And today's numbers are continuing that kind of story. Basically, you have 40% of the unemployed are suffering through not only a big recession, the aftermath of a recession, but a structural shift. I mean, essentially, the popping of two huge bubbles. If you were working somewhere related to the construction industry or the credit industry, those bubbles have burst in this recession, and those jobs aren't coming back, even though the recovery is here. And so for 40% of the unemployed people, they're unemployed well over 6 months. Their skills are starting to atrophy. It also includes some factory workers, because every recession we lose factory jobs, but then when the recovery comes, we never get it back. So this is one side of Main Street, practically, which is being left behind. The other side of Main Street, 60% of the unemployed are seeing short-term kind of unemployment. They lose their job for a month or two, and then they get a job back, and we're seeing the rebound in their job fortunes coming faster in this recovery than in the last two recoveries. And we could see it even in today's report. There's the household survey where it covers kind of smaller businesses. And over the last 2 months, they're estimating over 800,000 jobs added.
Well, Lakshman, that first group of people you described, the 40% of the unemployed who are long-term, who worked in construction or the credit industry, who those jobs have left and aren't coming back,
right.
that calls for major retraining efforts. It makes me wonder if the government or anyone else who can add to retraining for these folks is doing a good enough job.
Well, the answer is no. I mean, it's not the problem is not about to be solved because the recovery is here. This problem is not going to go away, and so therefore we know it's what we call a structural problem, not a cyclical problem. And when we look at the patterns of people who are out of work for a long period of time, we see that the only kind of environment where that number improves is when you have a very long expansion, like we had in the 1990s. We had a 10-year expansion, and long-term unemployment went way down because basically businesses said, hey, I need to hire someone. There's no one left. I'm going to take these long-term unemployed, and I'll retrain them myself.
And
it takes time, unfortunately.
And it also suggests that job creation efforts going on in, for instance, Congress right now giving tax breaks to businesses won't necessarily help this problem because it's not creating demand, and these people don't have demand for products. They have no money.
I mean, absolutely. I'm sorry to say this, but this problem will not be solved by anything out of Washington in the near term. This is a longer-term issue.
All right. Lakshman Achuthan, Managing Director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute. That's a market analysis company. Hey, Lakshman, stay with us because we're going to cover the week now, and we want to run some things by you, so stay with us.
Okay.
Because it's Friday, in cooperation with our friends at The Week magazine, we take a look and see who had a good week, who didn't, in our segment Good Week, Bad Week. First up, good week if you like to rant and you live in Nepal.
It's a time where you can just let loose and tell your friends and relatives what you really think of them. And some popular insults are things like monkey face, I hope your sons are as ugly as frogs, and I hope your buffalo die of diarrhea. And some even more obscene ones than this.
That was the BBC's Joanna Jolly in Kathmandu, Nepal. She's talking about a ritual going on right now where young people from neighboring villages in Nepal get to hurl insults at each other in an annual festival that they say is all good fun.
But apparently it's all very good-humoured, and parents don't really mind what their children say, and children can say what they like to older people, and it's a chance for everyone to just enjoy themselves and say what they really feel without it leading to an argument or a fight or something worse than that.
So, Anakshman, we were actually wondering if you had a favourite insult.
If I have a favourite insult, oh gosh, I might call someone an economist. How's that?
Celeste saves all her insults for me for internet messages. I want to point that out. They're there, but they're just on the internet. Well, Celeste, not everybody had a good week, of course. Paul Railton, a young London dog owner, is out about $100, and he even lost his driver's license while he was having a dog day afternoon.
This man, who's 23, was spotted taking his dog literally for a drive. I think that's the best way I could describe it. The dog was on the outside of the car, the lead was leading through the window inside the car, and Mr. Railton was driving down what I would describe as a country lane at some speed and allegedly taking the dog for a walk.
That was arresting Officer Trevor Watson from the Durham County Constabulary in England, and Officer Watson says that Railton got just what he deserved.
We hope he's learned his lesson. We hope he exercises the dog in a more conventional way and he gets to the streets and walks them outside of his vehicle, bearing in mind he now can't drive his vehicle. So that's got to be good for Mr. Railton, and I'm sure the dog's going to be much better off by having a proper walk. So we're pleased with the outcome.
Lakshman, maybe you can analyze this in terms of productivity numbers coming out of...
Just about. It sounds like he was watching one of those Chevy Chase vacation movies or something.
Yeah, it does sound kind of unbelievable. We always ask who you think had a good week or bad week in the news. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our site, thetakeaway.org, and you can see the full Good Week, Bad Week feature in The Week magazine that's on newsstands and online now.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this morning. Coming up, Iraqis go to the polls on Sunday for the nation's first full parliamentary election since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. We talk about whether they might be derailed by violence and more. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Right now, let's check in on some top stories at 31 minutes past the hour. The unemployment rate held steady at 9.7% in February, shedding fewer jobs than expected. The Labor Department said employers cut 36,000 jobs, but some economists say it may actually be a net gain of jobs because people who didn't get paid for having to stay home during recent snowstorms in the Northeast were counted as unemployed. We're getting more information, meanwhile, about last night's shooting at the Pentagon. Two police officers were wounded when a gunman, 36-year-old John Patrick Bedell, approached a security checkpoint, pulled a gun from his pocket, and opened fire. The shooter was killed when the officers, who were wearing bulletproof vests, returned fire. There had been concerns overnight Bedell might have had a partner, but earlier this morning, police chief Keevil said,
"At this time, and I emphasize at this time, there doesn't appear to be anyone else acting in concert with Mr. Bedell."
Police say they've had previous contact with Bedell.
A new report says the number of right-wing militia groups that see the U.S. government as their enemy more than doubled last year. That's according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. And some news out of Jerusalem this morning. Clashes have broken out between Muslim worshippers and Israeli police at the most sensitive holy site in the city. Taking a look at the markets, the Dow is up 30 points, the S&P is up 4, and the NASDAQ is up 11 points. The markets are opening higher a little today. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Election day in Iraq is this Sunday. This past week has seen a combination of electioneering and violence. Now, there's a lot at stake in these elections, in no small part because it'll determine who is in power when U.S. troops make a planned withdrawal from Iraq. That's supposed to be this summer. Tom Ricks is with us this morning. He writes the best defense blog on foreignpolicy.com, and he's author of The Gamble, General Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq. Tom, good morning.
Good morning.
Tom, I want to go right to the latest uptick in violence. There's some recent bombings in Baghdad and elsewhere, and widely seen as an attempt at scare tactics in the run-up to the election. Do they have any real chance of influencing or even derailing the process?
I don't think so. I think some violence is to be expected. I actually think it's been rather less than we might have seen. It's part of their script. Of the people who don't like the elections. I am actually much more worried about the 3 months after the elections.
Why so?
Because that's the period of government formation. Under the parliamentary system, you have 325 people elected out of about 6,000 candidates. Those 325 people then have to find themselves a president out of their group. Then the president sits down and says, okay, which of the coalitions are going to combine to propose a prime minister? That can take several months. Remember those purple finger elections back in 2005?
Sure, sure.
Those were a direct factor in leading to the Civil War of 2006 because it took so long to form a government that ethnic tensions really increased. And then when the new government came into power, it had a hard sectarian face on it. And that really antagonized Sunnis and lit the fuse for the Civil War that inflamed central Iraq in late 06 and early 07.
You have any feeling, Tom Ricks, that there have been any lessons learned from that first round of elections that when it comes time to for government formation, that they might be able to sidestep some of the landmines that they encountered in the past.
I'm sure they learned some of those things. My worry is that back in 06-07, it was the American intervention that really put a lid on that civil war and separated the parties and said, everybody calm down here. And the Americans are not prepared to play that role this time. The Americans are much more focused on trying to get their troop numbers down. We have about 100,000 troops there now, close to the average of what the Bush people had for many years, and they want to get it down to 50,000 by the end of August. That's a formidable task. And so I think you're not going to have the Americans around to bail them out, and all the things that caused violence last time, all the major questions about the future of Iraq are still out there.
Well, let's hear about that from General David Petraeus. He was on Charlie Rose on Thursday speaking to this issue.
The important change in August is that we will change our mission officially. We will go into the advise and assist mode rather than the combat mode, if you will.
Now, Tom Ricks, General Petraeus is saying that we will change our mission officially in August. He's saying that before we see what happens in the three-month aftermath of this election. That's a risk.
It is. It worries me because, while I think President Obama has generally done a very good job in dealing with these really hard issues, I worry that by sticking to deadlines, he's repeating a fundamental Bush administration mistake of rushing to failure, of insisting we're going to go by a date certain and we're going to toss the ball to the Iraqis no matter what.
And it's also possible that forces in Iraq, likely maybe, that forces in Iraq who read that date certain read it as a cue for when to instigate violence, I suppose. Well, violence is
just... There's no question that people are keeping their powder dry for the post-American future there.
And violence is just one part of the story. Perhaps an even bigger concern is something that Iraqi-born blogger Raed Jarar addressed. Jarar lives in the U.S. now, but he's going to be voting in these elections. We want to play some tape for him, Tom Rickson, and get you to react to it.
I am concerned about what would happen after the elections. I am afraid that we might end up having a situation similar to what happened in Iran after the election, post-election unrest, because there are many calls of fraud already.
Okay, so he's speaking much to the issue that you've been speaking about, Tom Ricks, but it makes me wonder if there is a security apparatus in Iraq in place to instigate the kind of post-election or political violence similar to what we saw with Tehran and in Iran?
Yeah, there are two aspects of that. The first is we really don't know how good Iraqi security forces are at this point. This is going to be a major test, especially when they don't have Americans around. How good are they? Who are they loyal to? Are they loyal to Maliki? Are they loyal to the government of Iraq? Are they loyal to sectarian groups or political parties? I've heard people give me answers of all those. The second thing is, how equitably do they behave? How decently do they behave when the Americans aren't around? Do they go back to the old Saddam ways? A lot of American advisors will tell you that that's what they expect from Iraqi forces once we're not there to keep an eye on them.
Well, Tom Ricks, is there any wiggle room in U.S. posture here? We heard from General David Petraeus, we are changing our mission in August. You're not the only one who's worried about it. Is there any flexibility in the U.S. approach here if things go wrong?
I think there's a lot of flexibility. I think President Obama has shown a lot of flexibility. Remember, he threw out his campaign promise, which was to take out a brigade a month from Iraq from the day he took office. If he had done that, we would have almost no combat troops left in Iraq.
Do we have political flexibility to stay there in a forward-leaning posture or even expand if we need to?
I think he does. I've knocked around the country a lot on paperback book tour in the last month, and what struck me is people understand Iraq is a mess. They don't blame Obama for him. They blame George Bush. They're sorry they ever heard of the place, but they're going to give him a lot of leeway in dealing with it.
And what about Iraqis, do you think? Their elections are coming up. Do they see this as the end to U.S. involvement in their country?
I don't think so. I think actually Iraq may reopen the question and ask us to keep some troops there for a long time.
They may. Tom Ricks, contributing editor to Foreign Policy magazine, writes the Best Defense blog for foreignpolicy.com. Thanks for joining us.
And by the way, there's another great conversation going on, actually a domestic one, and it's coming out of Atlanta. A team of white dancers won a traditionally black stepping competition. If you missed the story, you can learn more about it on our site, thetakeaway.org. But we've been asking you all morning, what does the story say about race?
Constance, Detroit, Michigan. Let's be real. People were upset when Tiger won his first green coat. An African-American had never done it before, and that is something that Caucasians owned, and they felt that that was fair. Now that Caucasians are stepping into something that are African-American, now it's like, what's the big deal? But America's history is like that. Caucasians come and take over.
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TICK and post to our site to hear more about that at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, more about Bobby McFerrin, the family behind the man.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. After weeks of anticipation, the Academy Awards is finally upon us, right? Everyone's been holding their breath, waiting to know. 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, Oscars will be handed out. Acceptance speeches will be cut off by either a hook or a playoff of music. Here to tell us about this year's show, which will be on ABC, is Rafer Guzman, Takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday. Well, they've been promoting a lot the two hosts this year, Steve Martin. And we also have Alec Baldwin. Now, Steve Martin, we've seen before. What are we expecting from these two hosts?
I think, I hate to say this because Steve Martin is a hero of mine. I mean, his early comedy albums changed my life. But I think we're going to be looking to Alec Baldwin to bring the fun for these things. I feel like Steve Martin's, he's been in a sort of a morose period lately. You know, he's been writing books like Shop Girl and things like that. And I don't know if you saw, it's complicated, but Alec Baldwin steals that movie, and he's hilarious in
it. He's a funny guy.
He really is, and he has the new reputation of being this comedic genius. Yeah,
and
so I think he'll be the one to watch.
Okay, so I'm wondering, what do you think about the structure of the Oscars? You know, they always try to do something every year to get the ratings up. What surprises are we expecting this year?
I don't really know. I think they've been a little tight-lipped on some of this stuff. I think what's going to be interesting is Mark Shaiman is the musical director. Now, if you don't know who he is, he's a Broadway veteran. Hairspray is probably his biggest, most best-known thing right now. Do you remember Billy Crystal's great Oscar medleys?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So Mark Shaiman wrote those.
Oh.
And he's back. And here's what's interesting. So he could do a good squeeze down of all the Oscar-winning
songs. They
got
to make it quick. Songs. They have 10... nominees.
But he's refusing, he says, I think he's serious, he's refusing to play off anyone in the middle of an acceptance speech.
Wow, really?
So who will make that cut, I don't know. But Mark Shaiman apparently says he will not be doing that.
And the question is, who is going to actually take advantage of that, since he's made that a public announcement?
That's right.
Who's most likely to get up there and not stop talking?
Sandra Bullock, that's my guess. That's my guess.
All right, so we're going to get the quick rundown from you on who you think is going to win. All right, Best Picture.
Got to be Avatar.
Okay. Best Actress?
Best Actress, I think, is going to be Sandra Bullock.
Really?
I think she's going to get that one for The Blind Side.
Okay, so Best Actor?
Best Actor will definitely be Jeff Bridges from Crazy Heart.
Okay, that's kind of a giveaway. Best Supporting Actress?
Supporting Actress, I think, will definitely be Monique from Precious.
Precious,
and
okay.
Deservedly so, I'd say.
And that's I agree with you there. Best Supporting Actor?
Best Supporting Actor is going to be Christoph Waltz from Inglourious
really?
Bastards. Yeah, I think he's just got it in the bag. I think he first of all, that movie wouldn't have been half as fun without him. He steals every single scene, and he's fantastic and a total unknown here. He's 53. He's been acting for quite a while. After that movie came out, he appeared in a lot of industry magazine covers. There was a big groundswell of support for him, and I think he's going to be the one to take it home.
Okay, so which of those winners that you just named off do you think shouldn't win?
I hate to say it, but I really don't think Sandra Bullock should be winning Best Supporting.
You mean Best Acting?
Thank you, Rafer.
Actress.
Thank you, Rafer.
I just don't see that. And I think Carrie Mulligan is up in that category, and she is so good in An Education. She's so wonderful in that. I like Sandra Bullock. I really do. I just don't think this is an Oscar-winning performance.
I like Sandra Bullock too, but I have to agree with you. Maybe this shouldn't be the one she should win for. All right. Well, the Oscar's going to be at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday on ABC. Rafer Guzman, thanks again. He's a Takeaway movie contributor and the film critic for Newsday.
Thank you.
Good morning and happy Friday. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Todd Zwillick, who is filling in for John Hockenberry. Coming up...
For those who have been trained by it, no discipline is better at the time of the paintball.
We're going to talk to... to renowned musician Bobby McFerrin. You certainly know him from Don't Worry, Be Happy. But do you know the story of his father and the power that family has to guide the rest of your life? We're going to talk about that in a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. The nation's unemployment rate was unchanged at 9.7% last month, the Labor Department says. Employers cut about 36,000 jobs. That was fewer than expected. Now into the Capitol, where authorities are providing a few details about the gunman who shot two Pentagon police officers at a subway entrance last night. They say John Patrick Bedell was heavily armed and had had previous run-ins with the law, but investigators have not yet found any connections to terrorism.
Overseas now, Sunday will be the start of three national days of mourning in Chile to commemorate victims of last Saturday's earthquake. And finally, organizers of this year's Oscar Awards ceremony think they finally figured out a way to keep acceptance speeches short. They're introducing a thank you cam. Winners will be asked to save all of their thank you speeches for a camera that will stream live onto the internet. The Academy's John Chirac explains how it will work.
As soon as that speech is over, walk off stage and thank everybody they want to thank and spend as much time doing it as they want.
That's Tom Chirac explaining the offstage, mind you, the offstage speechifier cam at this year's Oscars. I like it, too. The Oscars are on Sunday. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy.
Who does not know this song? And for many people, this is what they associate with the name Bobby McFerrin, the amazing voice behind Don't Worry, Be Happy and all those sounds that go behind it. But we're going to talk about something very different with Mr. McFerrin today. We want to talk a little bit about his family and how he came behind to his musical legacy. It's the story of the power of family.
How about that?
And shared history. Bobby McFerrin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, how are you?
So you're actually in New York this week to pay tribute to your father, who
is
Robert McFerrin.
I'm junior.
You are the junior. Most people don't know he was the first black man to perform at the Metropolitan Opera. He was there just days after Marian Anderson,
That's correct. Who lived in the same apartment building that we did.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right.
Was she a noisy neighbor?
Not at all. She's very quiet, very sweet.
But your dad, Robert McFerrin, sang, he was the singing voice of Sidney Poitier in the film version of Porgy and Bess, and we have a little clip of that.
Bess, you is my woman now. You is, and you must laugh and sing and dance for two instead of one.
That is a beautiful sound. That's like pure chocolate over
beautiful.
The ears. Yeah, he had a gorgeous, gorgeous voice.
He did, yeah.
Years before he performed with the Met, he performed on the stage of the New York City Opera.
City Opera, right.
And it was an opera called Troubled Island. The libretto was Langston Hughes, and the music was written by my grandfather, William Grant Still.
How about that?
How about that? We're going to play a little bit. This is kind of sketchy audio. It's from actually a rehearsal, I believe, of the 1949 production with your dad performing in Troubled Island. Story behind this opera, and your dad is a part of this period.
That's funny. I've never heard that clip.
You haven't?
No, I haven't heard it. No, that's wonderful.
Well, this opera was kind of pivotal in a number of different ways. It was written by two black men, not just white. It was the first opera by an African American to be performed by a major company. It prominently featured some African Americans in the lead. But actually, the thing that people may not realize is that most of the people in the cast were white people painted black. The two stars.
Wow.
Robert Weed was a white guy that they put dark makeup on him.
Right.
And so your dad was one of these, he was one of the rare, true people of color on the stage.
Well, you know, one thing I remember as a kid growing up is that whoever the black singers were in New York City at the time, they always seemed to congregate in our apartment because the place was always full of black people singing. And it was actually a wonderful experience as a kid sort of hiding under the piano while they'd sing and talk about the opportunities or the lack of opportunities that they had to, you know, perform their art. You know,
we actually found a recording of your dad's spirituals.
Did you really?
We did. Let's play it for you here.
I got
to lie down? How shall I rise? Ah, to lie down. How shall I rise? I got to lie down. How shall I rise? Pip before the judgment bar. I got to lie down. How shall I rise? Got to lie down. How shall I rise? I got to lie down. How shall I rise? Pip before the judgment bar. Dark was the night and cold the ground on which my Lord was laid. Great drops of sweat like blood ran down. In agony he prayed, I got to lie down. How shall I rise, got to lie down?
You know this song?
I do, well, yeah.
Did you ever sing it with your dad?
No, I never. Well, no, that's not true. One time we did. My sister, my mother, my dad, myself did a concert in St. Louis, I think in 1986. And it was just a one-time deal. It was my dad was the featured artist, and the rest of us were just sort of on
you were the backup
bill.
Singers
we were
for the famous Robert McFerrin.
Singers, that's right, yeah.
Well, you went a very different way in your style of music. What do you think you took away from your dad?
Oh, first off, just good singing, just good technique, and just how to really approach a song, a piece of music. He believed that if you are a singer, you've been given a gift. You know, God has entrusted you with a gift, and you need to do everything that you can, first off, to take care of yourself, not only your voice, but yourself, because yourself was your instrument. Your body was your instrument. Your mind is your instrument. Your spirit is a big part of your instrument. And to this day, when I sing, in many ways, I feel like I'm praying, you know.
I sat across from your dad when he was being inducted into the Arkansas Hall of Fame, and mm-hmm. he was a sweet, humble, soft-spoken man. I'm just wondering how you felt growing up, I guess, under his shadow. I mean, he was famous.
Well, you know, I think that's why it took me 27 years to figure out that I was a singer, because he was this incredible vocalist, and I wanted to do something else, and so I decided on composition, you know, being a composer and a pianist. And what's really funny is that the whole time that I was playing piano, I never felt like I was really a pianist. You know, I always had this nagging suspicion that wasn't my instrument. And then just one day out of the blue, it just fell on me that I'm a singer. And I started working right away. It's really amazing. I got an audition at a piano bar. I was living in Salt Lake City at the time, and I sang 5 songs. I was hired. I started a month later.
What'd you sing?
One of the songs was You Are the Sunshine of My Life, Stevie Wonder. Another one was a tune by a band called Blind Faith. Come down off your throne and leave your body alone. Somebody must change. And then I sang a tune by Joan Armatrading called Opportunity. Opportunity came to my dog.
Did you do that when you were auditioning?
When I was down on my luck. No. I don't think I did. No.
When did you start doing the percussive things and the other stuff with your voice? How did it meld into that?
You know, in the beginning, I wasn't really sure what kind of singing I was going to do, if I was going to continue to do piano bars, though I didn't think so. I thought maybe I might be a jazz singer and have a band. But the idea of being on stage by myself was really fascinating, and I kind of lifted the idea from Keith Jarrett's solo piano work. And I thought, well, what would it be like for a singer to be on stage by himself without a band, without any kind of accompaniment? And so I started working on that, you know. And I worked on it for 6 years before I actually did my first solo voice concert. And that's become sort of the, you know, the root of the tree, actually, the tree trunk of everything else that I do.
That was Bobby McFerrin. He has a new album out in April, Vocabularies, his first album in 8 years. And we have an exclusive preview right now. This is Wailers by Bobby McFerrin. You can hear that whole song at our website, thetakeaway.org.
Also, we've been having a great conversation this morning about that story about stepping in Atlanta and whether a team of white dancers should have won this traditionally black art form. If you missed it, learn more at the website, thetakeaway.org. And we've been asking you all morning, what does this story say about race?
This is Tom from Detroit. Why do some feel the need to co-opt a culture that is not their own?
It always irritates me when I'm watching a movie and you've got this family sitting around eating Chinese food with chopsticks. And I'm so sure that they are not really good at eating with those chopsticks, but for the moment, that's what they do. And I think that the Asians should get into an uproar about this because that is their culture, to eat with chopsticks.
8778MYTAKE is the number. Post your comments to thetakeaway.org. Now, next week, John will be co-hosting from Miami with our friends down at WLRN. While he's there, we're working with the BBC program World Have Your Say. They've got a special project 2 months after the Haiti earthquake. What does Haiti need from the world right now? And we're going to want to hear from you at 8778MYTAKE and on thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillig in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.